We're getting a status update now on broadband in our state. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. In Governor Evers' State of the State speech last month, he declared it the year of broadband access. His radio address last week.
2021 is a year that we will make real progress in tackling this critical issue and help expand access to high-speed internet so that students and educators, workers and small business owners, and folks all across our state are able to connect to the internet when they need it.
What is internet access like for you? Can you get online from home or do you drive to a parking lot hotspot? 800-642-1234. Chris Stark is a community and economic development agent with UW Extension based in Forest County. He's part of the Economic Development Administration University Center team for UW Extension, which does broadband research. Chris, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much, Kate. It's a pleasure to be here this morning. Thank you.
Well, let's start with where you are in Forest County. What does internet access look like where you are in Crandon, way up there in the northern part of the state?
Well, look, it's in Forest County, it's a real challenge for most residents and businesses and even the school district. Certainly some people, and we don't know exactly how many. We're always trying to measure this. Some people do not have access to the internet at all, and that's pretty representative of all of rural Wisconsin. Forest County is not unique in that regard. Generally, the county seat of Crandon has pretty good internet access, but the farther you go away from the county seat, you're more challenged to find broadband access. And again, it's really representative of all of rural Wisconsin.
Why is it hard to put your finger on how to measure who has it, who doesn't, and what their speeds are?
Well, everybody kind of does this a different way or has different recommendations. And it's been left up to the states, fine, and left up to local levels. I think a lot of the experts tend to agree that this is in many cases, this is a local issue because that's where the rubber meets the road, if you will. But some of that measuring comes from the failures, I suppose, of the FCC and the challenges with their mapping problems. The way it was initially set up under the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, if one house in a census tract was served with broadband, I'm simplifying here a little bit, but if one house in a census tract was served with broadband, that whole census tract was listed as served by broadband. Hmm. And so that created obviously some challenges for the community. It's overrepresented, if you will.
Yeah, very hard to get some accuracy there. Well, let's drill down to that local level issue. You have been in talks with the Crandon School District in Forest County about broadband access and how it's affected virtual learning. What have you learned?
Well, first of all, it's important to point out that the schools themselves have good broadband service in rural areas. They're served by WiskNet or just whatever it is, but the schools have good broadband service. But when the students and the teachers go home, too many of them are unable to have broadband access. So when the COVID-19 lockdowns began in March of last year, so almost 11 months into it now, the Crandon School District was unable to conduct classes virtually, and so they had to make the difficult decision to simply set out the students' homework periodically, maybe one time a week or every other week, and have the parents pick it up. They simply could not conduct classes because they didn't, not only the students, but the teachers also didn't have broadband. Now, I should point out that Forest County is kind of unique in Wisconsin in that they're the only county in the state that has two tribal reservations. We have the two Native American reservations here in Forest. One is we call the FCP, the Forest County Potawatomi, and secondly, the Sokagon Chippewa at Mole Lake. Both of these tribes are facing the same challenges with respect to broadband access that certainly all the Forest County residents are facing. And the tribes have representation or certainly been active, very active with us in pursuit of better broadband on the Forest County Broadband Commission. And I remember the Mole Lake tribal chair, now the former tribal chair, but of the Mole Lake tribe sitting at the table and with us discussing broadband and the importance of it. And he really singled out that the especially focusing on the importance of good broadband to the education of tribal youth. He understood that. And that is very important going forward, because if these students, all students, can't access, really, they can't do their homework. They can get it at the school again, but they can't do their homework, then they're going to be left behind.
Mm. Chris Stark is with us, Community and Economic Development Agent for UW Extension Forest County. He co-authored two reports, one looking at broadband and the economy, the other examining strategies and policy options for broadband. And getting your take on it, is your child learning from home? What problems are you seeing with their internet connection? What is internet access like in your part of the state? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Chris, from what I understand, Forest County is not unique. And you found that, you know, many residents across the state, all over the state, have issues with access to high-speed internet. So what does your report say in terms of what that looks like, whether it's Forest County or elsewhere?
Well, we can start off with the economic impact. In virtually every economic study you can find on the subject, broadband certainly has a positive effect on the local economy, because it increases employment opportunities in a given area. That's important to our businesses up here in the North Woods, but I should say the North Woods and rural areas in general are trying to attract telecommuters. In other words, people who want to live here, mm-hmm, because of the amenities of living in the North Woods, but can work remotely. And it's only possible with good internet. And I'll throw in one success story that I've seen, is that in the small community of Land O'Lakes, which is happens to be in eastern Vilas County, right up on the state line with the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, right after the town made a great effort by putting in, they anteed up a fair amount of money for a small community like Land O'Lakes to get broadband. They did not have good broadband service at all in the downtown of Land O'Lakes. They worked with a local provider to deploy fiber optic cable. And right after getting that good broadband service in 2017, they had a success story. They garnered a local business called Aaron Solutions, who worked with the local Economic Development Corporation and now has probably in the vicinity of, I'm not certain how many, but 12 to 15 decent paying jobs in that little community of Land O'Lakes. That is a big victory. And so that's one example of a success story with respect to broadband going into a given area and impacting the economy positively.
And that wouldn't have happened without that high-speed internet access. Those jobs wouldn't have been there.
Yes, would not have had a chance at all without that high-speed internet access. Other than that, you know, also, of course, we've covered the education and a little bit about the economy. But it's important to know that telehealth is a growing field, and especially under the pandemic, rural populations live a long distance from their doctors. They live even further from specialists. Not all visits, but many will be able to be conducted via the internet today. And I should point out that during COVID, even patients in urban areas, patients who lived close to their doctors, were telecommuting to avoid those in-person visits if they could.
Yeah. We're talking with Chris Stark. He's laying it out. Researches broadband access through UW Extension Forest County. He's explaining where our state is falling short in high-speed internet access and what can be done about it. Is your child learning from home? What problems do you encounter with internet connection for work and school? What do you want to know about the state of broadband in Wisconsin? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Chris Stark here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the high-speed internet situation in Wisconsin here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The pandemic has laid bare the decades-old issue of the digital divide. A report from Forward Analytics last month found more than 430,000 Wisconsinites lack access to high-speed internet. They make up a quarter of our state's rural residents. How much do you spend for connectivity? Can you afford it? Do you have competition options in your area for internet providers? Does your county have a grant for building up the infrastructure? How is that going? Be part of this 800-642-1234. Chris Stark is a community and economic development agent with UW Extension in Forest County and is studying the access problem. Chris, let's pivot here. Let's look for solutions, starting with grants. The State Public Service Commission recently awarded Forest County a roughly $1 million grant to help with infrastructure. How is that going?
It's going well. The total amount of the grant was $1.8 million because that grant, of course, is a 50-50 match, public to private, and the state matched Forest County. It's the anteed up. Imagine that, a community of the whole county, population about 9,000. Of course, the 2020 census isn't out yet, but about 9,000 people. Anteed up $900,000 and some change. I think it was $936,000, and matched a state grant. They put their money where they really emphasize what's important to them, and are leading the way with that. Now that grant that we're implementing right now is really we're working with a local provider called Northwoods Connect, and it's a hybrid company, meaning it deploys both fiber optic and wireless internet, and they put of course fiber optic in where it is feasible for the return on investment to do that, and wireless in a rural area has become an important source of broadband. Look, I think to be fair, everybody in the business knows that the end game and the best case scenario is to get fiber to the premises, what they call FTTP, fiber to the premises, whether it's your home or business. But in the interim, because of the cost of deploying fiber cable, wireless broadband in rural areas, especially with the sparser population, is a very realistic and workable solution. That is where deploying, I think, somewhere in the vicinity of 14 towers. And by the way, putting up those towers isn't easily done. It brings challenges itself to where can you find the land to, in some cases, you may need 2 to 3 acres to put up one of these towers. But nevertheless, we're making the effort, and they're really working hard on it in Forest County, showing that leadership. And really making a concerted effort to deploy this with the provider, I should say, to deploy wireless broadband in much of Forest County.
Well, we've heard the issue before where people say, look, I can see the fiber going in right there in front of my house. My driveway might be long. I might have a tree or two, but it's not getting to me. What is that issue like?
And I have heard that complaint so many times. And the only thing we can recommend is if you can find out who that company is specifically, and if you can contact them. Now, this is sometimes referred to as, it was initially referred to as last mile infrastructure. Now, it seems in a lot of cases, it's the last 100 feet.
Yeah, feet, right?
And it's a real challenge for a lot of people because they find that for that extra 100 feet of that fiber optic cable, they're going to have to pay quite an astronomical sum. That's why a lot of people have turned to alternative ways of types of broadband connections. There are actually five types, and fiber is the best one. Then you have cable. The cable companies run that. They might use coaxial cables usually, which is it can be a very good connection. It's again, not quite as good as fiber. DSL, which is what a lot of people have in rural areas, and it's less desired. It's a wired technology, and it uses traditional copper telephone lines that are already connected to homes and businesses. So speeds are going to vary with distance from the home to the nearest equipped telephone facility. And as I say, it's certainly less than desirable today. And you've got wireless, as we said, which can work point-to-point contact. Wireless, obviously, it's subject to obstructions. And in the North Woods, depending on what your terrain is, in the North Woods, obviously the trees present a challenge. And we happen to like those trees. But for wireless broadband, ideally for 4G broadband, if there were an ideal scenario and you were going, say, across a lake or something like that, you can probably have a range of as much as 10 miles from a tower to the home or business that it's serving. But with the obstructions of the of trees and everything and hills, that becomes a lot less. And then, of course, you have the option of, in some cases, of satellite wireless broadband.
We're talking with Chris Stark, who's with UW Extension, giving us the lay of the land as he studies high-speed internet access in our state and what the disparities are, what the impediments are. He co-authored a recent study looking at policy and strategy options for broadband access. Taking your questions and what your situation is getting high-speed internet where you are, 800-642-1234. Chris, you know, Reedsburg, Wisconsin, it's been held up as this poster child for getting fiber optic internet when, you know, communities were, it wasn't even on the radar in the early 2000s. What did Reedsburg do, and is it working now?
Reedsburg, I would say, came in under the wire, as far as I know, of statute 66.0422, which does cause, it would seem, some limitations on local electric providers. And I don't know, I've never spoken with anybody from Reedsburg, the broadband service there. What I have done is pulled up their website, and I see that they charge, and a lot of these throughout the nation as a whole, where they're provided opportunity by state law, and that's probably the key, state law, is that they seem to charge less and yet have better broadband service.
Where is the Public Service Commission in all of this, and what can lawmakers do to help internet access in our state?
Well, one of the things I think lawmakers can do, as far as the Public Service Commission, I think that they're working very closely. Of course, Jaron McCallum, I'm referring to. Jaron best answer that question. But I know they're working closely with us and with the broadband task force of the state. And so I'll focus on the first part of your question. I'll focus on that for a second. I'm well acquainted with the chair of that task force, Brittany Beyer, and have much confidence in Brittany. And what I would like to see is a strategy for broadband and recommendations. And I think that's precisely what they're working on. In other words, what works best from Wisconsin. And I have been on a few, certainly, Zooms with Brittany while we've contacted say the other states, the state of Washington broadband office. We've contacted the Pew Research Center, who has done a tremendous amount of research with respect to broadband throughout the nation. All of that goal being to bring back which best practices can we bring to Wisconsin, and what ideas should we recommend? And I certainly have a few favorites with respect to that.
Let's bring in a quick call now. Matt is with us in Nisida. Matt, hi, go ahead.
Hi there. So company SpaceX is currently rolling out a public beta of their Starlink satellite internet, and it's quite different from the typical satellite internet. People reporting from the public beta showing speeds of certainly 50 megabytes per second, but mostly, most cases, much higher. It's limited by latitude right now as SpaceX puts more satellites up. The lower latitudes will start being offered the service. And it's right now, I think, in the northern United States. It's the southernmost that it's available. But hopefully that'll solve a lot of people's
problems. Yeah, and Matt, we're short on time. I want to be able to get Chris to respond to the future of satellite service.
So thank you for that question, Matt. And I personally have not experienced Starlink. He's referring to Starlink, Elon Musk's Starlink. I had a constituent in Saint Germain who contacted me and let me know that he was using that, and it was very advantageous for him. Elon Musk is going to love my comment here, but it was very advantageous for this individual because he's a resort owner up here, and a small to medium-sized resort owner, which was pretty common in the Northwoods. He had about 8 cabins that he owned, and so that initial investment for the equipment of about $500 was very good for him.
Yeah,
and he pays about $100 a month.
And we have to end it there. Chris, thank you for joining us.
Kate, thank you so much for having us on the show.
Chris Stark is a community and economic development agent with UW Extension. Stay with us. News update is next on the Ideas Network. Here with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life, and this month marks the program's 10th anniversary on WPR. As part of the celebration, here's Wisconsin Life's co-founder, Todd Witter, reflecting on two of his favorite stories that feature quintessential Wisco culture, deer hunting and the fish fry.
Finding ways to be with our neighbors in their space, you know, where they work, where they live, doing what they love or what they do just to get by. Those were things that guided me when producing stories for Wisconsin Life when we started it 10 years ago. Wisconsin is just so colorful with creative, committed, hardworking people. And my goal was to share each unique voice with our listeners. It was a chance to simply know someone. Sometimes I was able to create what I think of as a moment. It's like a snapshot or a postcard. They were only about a minute long. They were really tough to produce, but also really rewarding. Being able to drop in and experience a moment and come away with something that felt incredibly real, that was really special. And I have two of them today. The first one is with well-known Wisconsin author Michael Perry. I spent the day with him on his farm. He talked about raising chickens and writing, and well, we took this brief aside in his barn. I never actually planned to use this for a story, but later realized it had to happen. He started to show me this device that he had built, and I'm going to let him tell you.
Over here, you can see this homemade deer skinning device. This is one of the few things that I made and designed that worked out pretty good, but it's made out of a ratchet from a boat trailer. You know, you see people hauling their boats in from the water. I use that ratchet, and I bought some cable and a couple of pulleys. And then that's called a snatch block arrangement, where it goes up to the rafters and back over the two pulleys. And then what you do is you get your deer out here and you hook the deer to the pulley, and then you raise the pulley. And when it gets to a certain height, you start skinning the deer with your knife. And then once you get the skinning started, you take this vise grip and you just clip it onto the hide. And you hook the chain to the frame, which is immovable, and then you hook the chain through the wrench that's attached to the deer hide. Turn this ratchet, and it lifts the deer up, and it just pulls the hide right off. So that's redneck engineering at its finest, if I do say so myself.
This is such a vivid piece of audio. I don't think I've ever used the word visceral in my everyday speech, but for some reason, the word visceral seems the right word to use right about now. Another moment that I absolutely love. I was producing a story about one of the most quintessential Wisconsin experiences, the Friday night fish fry. And while you can find a fish fry just about anywhere in the state, Merrick's in Green Bay is a favorite of many, and for good reason. The Merrick family has been fishing in Green Bay since the 1890s. Much of their catch is what they serve for their fish fry. It's just incredible. Anyway, I was there with a food writer. We're talking about Wisconsin's fish fry culture and why Merrick's is so special, but then I took a moment to slip into the fairly small kitchen there and met the industrious Tony Melton.
Okay, well, I just grab a basket full of perch, just like this.
Tony Melton, fish fry chef at Merrick's in Green Bay.
I try to keep the boneless perch up with him because that's what we use the most, is the boneless. And that's your headless perch. And then down here at the bottom, we have the rest of our stuff, and we take it like this, Boom, boom, shake it, throw it in, and that's it. If you'd given six on the doubles and then the triples get nine, so.
5 times 3, 1,500.
So it's anywhere from 3 to 5,000 we serve. That's quite a bit of fish. That's quite a bit of fish.
When I listen back to Tony and I hear that fryer behind her sizzling and bubbling, I can see it and I can smell it. And it's just one of those moments that I can't forget. It's what I mentioned earlier, being able to be in someone's space for just a moment to get to know someone a bit more than we typically allow ourselves. And I'm so grateful to the people that I met doing Wisconsin Life Stories, the people who were so inviting and honest and openly shared a bit of their world with me and with all of us. It was an honor. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Todd Witter.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're checking back in now with Wisconsin Life. Here is producer Maureen McCollum with a dream about hibernation. The story was written a couple of years ago, but in the midst of the pandemic, it may be more relevant than ever.
Some animals hibernate to survive the winter. Humans aren't included in that group, but that hasn't stopped writer Krista Eastman from imagining her perfect winter abode.
Before natural historians understood that some birds fly thousands of miles south each winter, they looked for other ways to explain their disappearance. Birds were like snakes, they suggested, burrowing for themselves a hibernaculum, an earthy pocket in which to pass the winter. Under the ground, the robin slumbered, her heart beating once in a while, her open throat not tweeting at all, her feathers caked in grit. This was another way to survive the winter, digging in, admitting no one, waiting for this too to pass. Deep into the winter blues, I awake to early morning darkness and wonder, is there really no other place for people and animals to live? Is there no other way? Some people are practical in coping with the season. Swift in booking cheap flights to Florida, they do not hesitate, they do not dally, they just depart. I am a member of that other tribe, those who dig in, those who let their thoughts grow warped on the grayest light of winter. At some point, usually around January 14th, I surrender to the season. My most insignificant problems begin to appear to me as uncontainable irritations, crosswords I'm much too grumpy to solve. It's hard, then, not to fantasize about my own hibernaculum, how I'd stock mine with a 5-month supply of coffee, chocolate, cheese, and wine to be consumed in that order every day, all winter long. Add to that a pile of books and a landline that only dials out for delivery. This would be the season of slow and silent contemplation, moderate melancholy, little to no exercise. A wise friend of mine claims this is what winter is for, a natural slowing down, a time to reflect, a not-so-unhealthy space for feeling a little bit sad. If it were possible, I think I'd also loft my hibernaculum in a tree and make of it a warm and protected nest. And then I'd also probably appoint someone responsible for yanking open the nest trap door once spring had truly come. I'd fall to the ground in an unwashed heap, stand up, blink my eyes. I imagined then that my pitying neighbors would gather round to watch as I stood for the first time in months, stretching muscles, cracking joints. She smells even worse than last year, one of them might mutter, as I crab walk off to the lake for a bracing spring rinse. But I won't do any of that, of course, not really. I will climb out of bed when my son wakes each morning. I will be on time for work. I will remember to bring home that carton of eggs. But someday I will also emerge vainglorious from winter's pocket. It will be suddenly warm, and I will be suddenly awake, and soon, my naked ankles frisky from sun, I'll wonder, what could be better than here? What way is there but this?
Krista Eastman's essays have appeared in the Georgia Review, the Kenyon Review, and other journals. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit our website at wisconsinlife.org and find us on Facebook and on Twitter. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You can hear a decade of Wisconsin Life and more here on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Now we're looking for clarity in the GameStop story and what the short squeeze phenomenon says about the stock market and Wall Street. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What questions do you have about stock prices or day trading? Have you followed GameStop's sky-high short interest and then its plummet? What do you wonder about the long and short of it? 800-642-1234. Keith Ponywaz is Director of International Advisory Services and a financial advisor with Wafner Condon Financial Advisors in Madison. Keith, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me, Kate.
Well, explain for us, so we're all on the same page, what a short squeeze is. How would you describe it to us?
Well, I think, you know, in order to understand a short squeeze, you probably first should know and make sure that everybody knows what a shorting of a stock is. And shorting a stock is basically a bet that the security is going to go down in price. And the way you do that is, and let's take GameStop as an example. I'm not endorsing any of this behavior or anything like that. But in the case of GameStop, say you own, Kate, a share of GameStop, and I want to bet that it's going to go down. And so what I do is borrow that share from you. Mm-hmm. And I sell it right away. So when GameStop all started, it was trading at about, you know, $20 a share. And so my bet is I'm going to be able to go in, buy that share back at $5 a share, let's say, and make $15 on that share. Well, what happened was, you know, on Reddit, lots of people noticed that there was lots and lots of short interest in that, which meant lots of people were doing what I was doing. And so what that led to is people deciding to go long or buy that stock. Well, in a lot of cases, when I'm borrowing a stock, I may only have, let's in the example we're giving, $100 in my bank account, and I know I need to buy back that share. Well, as the prices rise, when you know more people are buying it just to buy it, I start looking at my bank account and I go, oh boy, it's $80 a share now, $90 a share, and so I'm starting to feel that squeeze, and I feel the need to buy it as well, and that levers, you know, adds to the demand for buying that share, that further increases the price. And that's where you get the short squeeze, which is people trying to buy back shares that they've borrowed and then sold. And so, it's really a fundamental supply and demand thing, right? The supply of stock stays the same, but more of us who have, you know, borrowed that stock and need to buy it back are now racing back into the market to cover it. And you know, one of the big problems is these various hedge funds that had shorted the stock, they may not have the funds on hand to cover their shorts, and so that's why they're racing in. And so you have, you know, that accelerates it. And you'll see this phenomenon, you know, in various times throughout the market, particularly around the earnings season.
What do you make of these investors on Reddit, though, banding together to send GameStop stock price soaring? And as a result, these hedge funds who bet against the stock, as you say, you know, they're facing major losses. Is this the start of a revolution on Wall Street? Or is this, you know, is it a bubble that is bound to burst?
Well, you know, first of all, we have to, you know, take into context the number of shares that are being traded and its relevance to the overall market. You know, one thing, when GameStop was having its biggest days last week, the overall market was actually down. And then Thursday or Friday of last week, you know, the inverse was the case. So I think it's dangerous to read out further trends from this because, you know, GameStop is a small part, and we see, not to this extent, but we see short squeezes like this, you know, all of the time. They may not, you know, lead to a stock going up 500%, but part of it is what's unique about these various companies is, in a lot of cases, they are not what we'd call, you know, they're very easy to move because they generally have low trading volume.
Mm-hmm.
You know, bigger stocks tend to have higher trading volume, and that makes it harder for them to move.
Let's bring in a call now. Ethan is with us from Madison. Hi, Ethan. What would you like to ask?
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to know what the guest had to say about all of these smaller brokerage platforms limiting the trading on stock and therefore manipulating the value because, you know, people can't buy, can't increase the demand. And still to this day, they're still fairly limited. And I just want to know how that isn't market manipulation. I know Robinhood says that's their clearinghouse and other reasons why they had to do that. But we see, like you said, short squeezes like this happening all the time with high volume, so that seems kind of fishy to me.
Ethan, thanks. Yeah, Keith, go ahead.
Yeah, well, there are a couple of issues in play, and you know, there are a variety of reasons why this freaked out Wall Street, you know, these brokerage houses. And, you know, you know, in one case, what Robinhood and other traders have said is basically their clearinghouses, the people that match up the buyers and sellers, were worried about being stuck on the hook with shares that may not have buyers on the other side ultimately. And part of that was due to the fact that one of the ways that you can further maximize your profits if you're doing this sort of trading is by buying options.
Mm-hmm.
And the end of January, which we saw, it was a big options expiry date. And what a lot of people who were using Robinhood, for instance, didn't realize is that on February 29th, that Robinhood automatically executed their options, which meant an option is essentially I buy for a little bit of money the option to buy the stock in the future at a defined value. So with GameStop, when it was trading at 20, I might buy an option to buy it at 80, and when it was up at 400, you know, that's an option that would then be worth, you know, $320 that I may have paid a dollar or two. And what Robinhood was doing was they had in their contract that in the money, that is profitable options, they would automatically fulfill and put into your account. Well, what happened and they were worried about is that many of these small traders may not have been able to buy. Most options work in about 100 quantities of 100 shares of GameStop for, you know, even $100 a share in order to then resell them and make the profit. So that was one concern, and that was the concern of their clearinghouses. So I think there's going to be more investigation, but, you know, we should be careful to immediately ascribe, you know, the worst motives to the various, you know, brokerages, especially the smaller ones, because, you know, Robinhood, I think, all of a sudden found themselves a little bit like the dog that catches the car. They became, you know, very, very popular all of a sudden, and they may not have had the resources and capital to be able to handle all the volume that they saw.
We're talking with Keith Ponywaz, who is Director of International Advisory Services, a financial advisor with Wachner Condon Financial Advisors. You can join in. What did you see out of the GameStop story? What do you want to understand about how trading works? 800-642-1234 to join in. Tom is with us from Burlington with a question. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
It seems like it's getting like the tulip thing. They were buying tulips in Holland 200 years ago and went crazy for these tulip seeds. But anyway, what I wanted to ask was years ago in 1938, they put in the rule that you couldn't sell short. You could only sell short on an uptick. And so this was to stabilize the market and keep people from being able to drive the market down. Then they took that rule off, I think in 1978 or something or other. And then they put it back, and they've done this. So I wonder, could you address yourself to that, this thing about the uptick rule that, in my opinion, they should have the uptick rule back there because you can drive that price down. It just keeps going down and down and down, and that's it.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Tom, thanks.
Well, and I think Tom addresses one of the bigger things is that people who short are commonly viewed as sort of the villains of Wall Street, right? That they can just drive prices down and down and down. And the uptick rule is one of the ways to moderate that. And then the other thing that a lot of people worry about is what's called high-frequency trading, which is trading that can take information that's out there and move, you know, that move on trades that consumers might be making a little bit faster than consumer and take a little bit of that. I think there's some, you know, validity to thinking about that longer term. And, you know, I also think that, you know, looking at ways to make markets fairer for consumers is ultimately a good thing. But I will say, you know, in terms overall of the efficiency of the market, you know, I'm Tom, you know, going back to 1938 is probably old enough to remember when, you know, stock prices were listed in the newspaper on eighths, right?
Yeah.
Of a dollar. And so that gap between, you know, the eighths often went to the brokerage firms, and now we're able to price stocks, you know, almost down to the penny. And that efficiency has been passed on to retail investors as well. So I think, you know, we want to make sure we want to continue to improve the efficiency of the markets, but, you know, and it's continuing the way it's been going.
Let's bring in Tom in Madison. Tom, hi, go ahead.
Good morning. First, I guess I should state that I would really like to see the whole concept of short selling made illegal, but that's just a side remark. My question deals with liability. My son participates in the Robin Hood model. I don't fully understand it, but he claims to be proficient at it. He's 27. I know he's made money and lost money, but I'm a co-signer on his savings account at the UW Credit Union. What if he loses, $300,000 on some trade? What's my liability?
Tom, thank you. Keith?
Well, Tom, unfortunately, that would be a question for a lawyer. It's not something I can necessarily answer in this situation because, you know, there are more details and so on and so forth. But I think, you know, Tom raises one of the good points as well about short selling and something that people should be careful of. It is a way that you can, and all of this sort of day trading, people can lose a lot of money in it. And, you know, if people are interested in these short-time things, they should not be gambling their, house money or anything like that. You know, at most, things like GameStop, from my perspective, you know, they move a lot in as randomly, especially over the short term, as, you know, any sort of gambling. Over the long term, you know, the stock market relies on facts and figures.
Do your homework, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Keith, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Keith Ponywaz, Director of International Advisory Services and a financial advisor with Wachner Condon Financial Advisors. Just ahead, an investigative reporter from the New York Times breaks down pandemic-related medical billing. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.